On December 9, 2022, Dr. Peter M. Sandman was interviewed via Zoom by emergency management expert Eric Holdeman for his podcast, Disaster Zone.
Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Most organizations have access to incredibly powerful technologies, but struggle to use them to their full potential. Bent Ears team of experienced technology and operations professionals systematically help organizations get the most out of the technology they already own. You can find them at www.BentEarSolutions.com. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. I'm very pleased to tell you that today we have a guest who is internationally known for his knowledge about risk and crisis communications. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Peter Sandman to the Disaster Zone podcast. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Peter, we met when we hired you actually to do two different communications workshops for us, separated by a couple of years. And I don't know if you remember, I said I played the music, Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. You didn't seem that pleased with it, but you did play it. Why don't we start out with you providing. And I'm emphasizing brief overview of your work background expertise because you've done so much in the area of risk and crisis communication.
Well, I think my main contribution to the area of risk and crisis communication is the distinction between what I call hazard and outrage. That is how dangerous something is versus how upset people are about it. And if you think of that sort of in a simple-minded way, it's a 2x2 table. It's either very dangerous or not very dangerous, and people are very upset or not very upset, so that you just have four quadrants. If it's not very dangerous, but people are very upset, that's one kind of risk communication, which I call outrage management, trying to calm people down. If it's very dangerous and people are not very upset, that's a second kind of risk communication, trying to rile people up, trying to get them more upset so that they'll take precautions. If they're upset and it's dangerous, that's your field. That's crisis communication. That's trying to guide them through a situation where they're right to be upset. The fourth quadrant, if it's not very dangerous and they're not very upset, I never found that to be a profit opportunity. You know, I mean, what would you say in that fourth quadrant? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. So I think that's not very interesting. But if it's dangerous, whether or not they're upset, and if they're upset, whether or not it's dangerous, there's some kind of risk communication to be done. One of them is crisis communication. One of them is precaution advocacy when you got to warn them about something they're ignoring. And the third one is outrage management when you're trying to calm them down because they're freaking out about nothing.
Okay. All right, Peter, you did very well on answering my second question, but not the first one. And this four quadrant thing that Peter just said, go back, rewind that, copy it, because as he said, this put all his the kids through college, the one he just gave you that snapshot on. So why don't you start? In fourth grade, did you say, oh, I want to become a risk communications expert? How did you end up where you are today? You got a degree in what, engineering? And then,
okay, that's your first question. All right, I'll answer that one now. I was in graduate school getting a PhD in communication. I got interested in environmental communication. And it was quite late in my doctoral work. I'd actually already started work on a dissertation on another topic entirely. And an opportunity came up to be funded if I did research in environmental communication. So, you know, that made me basically switch dissertation topics.
Now, is this in the 70s? That's when environmental...
This would have been in the early 70s. That's right. Okay. And, you know, so I got my PhD, and it turned out I was one of the world's only experts in environmental communication. This is, you know, pre-Google, pre-internet. And if you tried to do a literature review on environment and a literature review on communication, and you looked for where the Venn diagram came together, you got me, and not very much else. So when I went to Rutgers University, getting the order wrong. I taught first in the journalism school at Ohio State. And I was at Ohio State teaching pretty ordinary journalism and publishing in environmental communication, because that's what young academics do, right? You publish, you cannibalize your dissertation. And I got a call from the University of Michigan. They were setting up a program in environmental communication, and they wanted someone to run it. And they went looking for who does that, and all they found was me. So it wasn't much of a competition. So I wound up in this, this is just post Earth Day. I wound up at the University of Michigan, basically training environmental propagandists. Basically figuring out how do you scare people about the environment? How do you convince people to recycle or convince people to worry about climate? All those kinds of issues. That's what I now call precaution advocacy. And I did that for a while. In some sense, I've been doing that ever since, but I did only that for a while. And then, a few years later, in the mid to late 70s, I got interested in the other side, having spent years now trying to figure out how to alarm people when they were apathetic. I got interested in, what do you do when they're excessively alarmed? What do you do when they're more upset than they ought to be? So I started, I originally framed this as apathy versus hysteria. That's right. I wrote on apathy versus hysteria. Apathy being when you're not upset enough, and hysteria being when you're too upset. And it was the 80s by the time I reframed that as hazard versus outrage. And I got interested in, what do you do when the outrage is greater than the hazard? What do you do when the outrage is less than the hazard? The third paradigm, crisis communication, I mostly got into after Three Mile Island. I'd been invited to work on Three Mile Island, first for Columbia Journalism Review, and then for the Kemeny Commission that the government created to investigate the accident at Three Mile Island. And that got me interested, since TMI was obviously a crisis.
And all right, now I have a Three Mile Island question.
Okay.
Back in the day, and I was doing, emergency management work, reference nuclear power plants. There's one in Washington State. And the comment was made, if you flew intercontinental from one coast to the other in an airplane, you got more radiation than what was being, you would have gotten in the Three Mile Island accident. Is that true, or you never heard that phrase before?
I've heard things like that said. And, look, if you flew right over the plume, when radiation was escaping from Unit 2 at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, if you got into a helicopter and flew right over the plume, you got a significant amount of radiation, more than you're going to get in a transcontinental flight. If you lived 3 or 4 miles away, you got a hell of a lot less radiation. But the problem at Three Mile Island was never what happened. It was what looked like it was about to happen.
A Chernobyl-like meltdown.
Well, yeah, since we're talking about this, let's talk about it, right? If you take conditions at Three Mile Island, on day two of the accident, and you pump them through the Babcock and Wilcox model, the simulation that the people who made the plant created in order to predict what would happen under various conditions. In according to that model, they had a meltdown. They didn't have a meltdown because, you know, reality was more forgiving than the model. We now know that the hydrogen bubble that was in the containment but had escaped the reactor and was being contained only by the containment, we now know that that bubble wasn't about to explode. It looked like it was about to explode. The NRC thought it was about to explode. So this was a genuinely very serious crisis that turned out not to be a big deal.
Okay. So, we don't have to, talk only about Three Mile Island, but it's the example, as you speak to us, you have the details of it, for communicators, and a lot of times emergency managers are relying on their public information officer, public affairs officer. You have great detailed knowledge on this. Do these communications people need to really dig in and understand everything and not just be reading, what they've been handed? I mean, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, communications people are, for a company or for a government agency, are journalists working inside, and they should think like journalists. So when the technical people give them information, they should look at that the way a reporter would look at it and ask the technical people inside their organization the questions a good reporter would ask. And only after you kind of, have extracted from your technical people the information they either wanted to keep secret because it was awkward and embarrassing, or they weren't smart enough to realize that everybody would be interested in it, whatever the reason they left it out or they misstated it, once you've got it clear, then you get to decide as the company's communicator, how much of this does the public need to know, or does the public want to know, or is it in my interest or the public's interest to tell them? There's certainly a gap between how much you need to know before you write the story and how much you put in the story. But if you don't know anything more than the technical people told you, then you're not doing your job.
Okay. All right. Well, again, we're covering in 45, 50 minutes, whatever, what you would do in a 2-day workshop. And I took copious notes, by the way, on when I sat in those workshops. So is one of the two types of communications more important to master? It seems that, at least in the emergency management business primarily, that we're always in risk communication and that it is used on a more frequent basis, depending on your business and risk. And for example, I think generally I'm trying to fight apathy out there because I've got the four stages of denial. It won't happen. If it does happen, it won't happen to me. If it does happen to me, it won't be that bad. And then the last one is, if it does happen to me, is that bad? Well, I'll be dead, which is thinking, because only about 2% of the population actually dies in a catastrophe. So don't plan on being dead, plan on being alive. So when I don't do too many of these anymore, a preparedness presentation, I entitle it, No One Is Coming to Help for a Large Scale Earthquake. That, no one is coming to help. So that's your planning assumption. And I talk about that, drill it in numerous times and end it with, remember, no one is coming to help. So it's that risk communications more important than crisis, or you need to be able to master both?
Well, obviously you ought to be good at all the kinds of communication that your job calls for. But just as obviously, in your career, if you're a normal communication person, in your career, you will have the least frequent but most important need for crisis communication. You're not going to face crises very often, but when you face them, it's going to be what you're remembered for. If 20 years later, after your only crisis, that'll be the first paragraph of your obituary, how you handled the crisis. So it's the least common and most important thing you do. But for most of us, most of the time, the way we save lives is not with crisis communication, but with precaution advocacy, with trying to warn apathetic people, including warning them about possible future crises. Pre-crisis communication isn't the kind of crisis communication. It's a kind of risk communication. It's telling people about the risk that they might face a crisis. So they ought to pack a go kit, and they ought to, get vaccinated in case they face the pandemic. So the thing we do day after day, year after year, that saves lives is precaution advocacy. The thing that most threatens our organization's reputation is outrage management. I mean, what kills organizations is when people think they're going to die, even if they're not. When people are angry and frightened, that's what gets them to shut down your industry, or to shut down your factory, or shut down your refinery, that's what destroys companies. So if you're worried about your company, outrage management is probably the most important thing you're going to do. If you're worried about saving lives, precaution advocacy is probably the most important thing you're going to do. And once or twice in your career, everything else is trivial and you're facing a crisis.
Yeah. And now you're talking about the worried well is a more common term used a lot. And we certainly saw that with COVID, but you can see it with other, a chemical release type of thing. And I know, again, we don't have time to cover everything, but I remember you talking about don't tell people everything's fine. Why don't you talk to that aspect of it? I mean, don't over reassure them, that piece. I know you talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, over reassurance is a extremely common mistake, both in crisis communication and in outrage management. In outrage management, you're right when that people are more upset than they ought to be. And even there, it's not useful to tell them to calm down. I mean, for one thing, calm down is not a calming message, especially if your tone sounds like what you're saying is calm down, you hysterical fool. What an idiot you are to be upset. That's not calming. So even when people are wrong to be upset, even when they face a trivial risk and they're freaking out about next to nothing, it's still useless to tell them to calm down. And in an actual crisis, when what they face is serious, then it's dishonorable to try to tell them to calm down. And it's dysfunctional because you need their alarm, you need their upsetness in order to motivate them to take precautions. So it's never a good message. It's sometimes the right goal and sometimes the wrong goal. It's never the right message.
Okay. Well, and you kind of talked about this already. And in my limited experience compared to yours, of course, it appears to me organizations are not ready to conduct crisis communications, even though they have professional communications personnel on staff. You talked about how they handle it will be the lead line in their obituary. Now, likely it's because they're not doing this type of work day to day. How do you get prepared to do that? I mean, what should a communications professional who has not had to do crisis communications get ready for?
It's a good question. And I'm not sure I know the answer. I mean, I can train people train is probably the wrong word. I can teach people how to do crisis communication, but I can't give them experience in doing crisis communication. Only a crisis can do that. Now, various kinds of simulations can help. After you've learned how, at the very least, you ought to do some kind of simulation where you try it out. But we all know that simulations are better than nothing, but only a little better than nothing, and a lot worse than actual experience. I don't know any way to get good at crisis communication except managing a bunch of crises. Yeah. So basically, I mean, what I wind up saying is learn how, and when a real crisis happens, bring in an expert, but know enough about how that you know which expert to pick, and you know enough not to overrule the expert when she tells you to do something you wish you didn't have to do.
Yeah. You know, a favorite quote of mine is wisdom comes from experience, and experience comes from making mistakes. So, you talk about simulations, it'd be disaster exercises for this, but you need someone there who can critique what is being said. One of the things I keep saying about, if you do an event or type of thing, and you think you did a great job, as actually was a negative learning experience if you didn't do a good job, because you're going to think, well, this is how it works.
That's right. I worked with some of the exercises for natural disasters, and I worked on some of the exercises for pandemics, and I worked on some of the exercises on terrorist attacks. And I think you're right. The government traditionally thinks the better the exercise goes, the happier they are, and that's wrong. What you want an exercise to do is cock up badly, so that when the real crisis happens, you won't have those particular cock ups. So I think you're right. You learn nothing from a successful exercise.
And it's interesting. Before we go to break, I'll just share here that. In every exercise, no matter what, emergency managers know this already, that there will always be a finding about communications need to be improved. Now, but yeah. The emergency managers are thinking it's the radio communications, it's the email messages, it's who we coordinate with. But there's this other part of communications we're talking about today, that piece we're not really talking about when we say communications needs to be improved. So hopefully something will come out of our podcast today people can pick up on. So with that, I want to take a quick break for a message from one of our sponsors. And when we get back, we'll pick up and we'll be talking about COVID and the pandemic and how everything went just famously during that. So stand by. Most organizations have access to incredibly powerful technologies, but struggle to use them to their full potential. Bent Ears team of experienced technology and operations professionals systematically help organizations get the most out of the technology they already own. You can find them at www.BentEarSolutions.com. And we are back and talking with Peter Sandman, a risk and crisis communications expert. And as I said, Peter, recognizing that you're giving us the 2-day workshop in this very brief podcast, but can you outline the principles of risk communications and then where people can get more information on the topic? We talked just prior to the break about trying to get experience in crisis communications, but now risk communications, maybe that's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I mean, as I said at the very beginning, you divide the world into two things, crisis communication and risk communication. I divide it into three, crisis communication, precaution advocacy, and outrage management. And I've worked in all three, and I have guidelines on my website and case studies and far more than anybody wants to read on my website about each of the three. So if people want to know more, at least if they want to know more about my approach, there are other approaches. www.psandman.com is, in my judgment, at least the place to go. Taking them one at a time. I mean, for crisis communication, I have a list of 25 recommendations ranging from, don't over reassure and acknowledge uncertainty and be willing to speculate and things of that sort, to don't aim for zero fear, don't make fun of the public's emotions, tolerate early overreactions, involve the public, all the way down to tell the truth, apologize when you screw up. I've got a list of 25 crisis communication recommendations. I wouldn't say they're the only 25 things worth doing. They're the 25 things, it seems to me, that are often done wrong. I have, for outrage management, a much shorter list of six key outrage management strategies. And they're very hard to explain because they're counterintuitive. I mean, I think the crisis communication ones are much more, you know, you understand why you shouldn't over reassure. But the outrage management ones are much more hard to grasp. But I'll you know, again, I go into a lot of detail on my website about them, but let me at least explain one or two of them.
Well, I'll give you one.
Okay.
And I want you to know that as a, you're the rabbi, I don't know what your religion is, but I'm the disciple here. And I was asked, now this is probably, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, seems like a while ago, to facilitate, moderate a very angry community meeting where the Corps of Engineers had released too much water and caused flooding in a community, and they were not warned that this was all going to happen. And I had an opportunity to meet with the people who are going to be up front. And this is why I told them, I got this down. Again, this is all Peter Sandman talking, is you're going to sit up there. You're going to take notes. We're not going to talk about what we did in advance. We're going to hear from all these angry people first, because if you're talking, they aren't listening because they want to vent. So they're going to talk. Eventually, someone will get up and say, stop talking, let's hear from these people. And then that's when you get to give your message. And I want you to tell you, that's exactly what happened. You know, they just vented. And I told people, just take notes, don't respond. And eventually that angry guy got up and said, stop talking. We need to hear from these people. So I want you, and it worked. So
yeah, that's beautiful, Erica. I think that's exactly right. If you're doing outrage management, you're dealing with people who are upset and you want them to get calmer. First, you listen, and you listen until they demand that you talk.
Yes.
And then when they finally demand that you talk, the first thing you do is echo. You don't get to your message. You start telling them about their message. You say, if I'm hearing you guys right, there are three things you're really angry at us about. You're mad about A, you're mad about B, and you're mad about C. So, when you finally get the floor, you're still not going to tell them why you're right and they're wrong. You're going to tell them what they think.
Yeah.
And it's only after that that the first thing you get to after you echo is points of agreement, of what they said that you think too. And very late in the game, after they're much calmer than they started out, you can begin to talk about the things you think they're wrong about.
Yeah. I just want to say,
you got that beautifully.
This is a type of advice you can get from Peter Sandman's website, because our natural inclination is to get up and say, well, you guys don't know what happened. Let me tell you what happened. And they're not listening. So what else do you have to say there, Peter? But I just want to say the formula worked for me anyway.
It's a good one. I'll give you another good one that I think people miss all the time. Give away the credit for things you've done that angry stakeholders wanted you to do. I mean, what typically happens is you want to do X, they want you to do Y, they put a lot of pressure on you to do Y, and you really don't want to, but you have these internal meetings and you say, oh God, we've got to do Y, they're so mad at us, we better do what they want. Okay, so you make a teeth-gritted decision to do Y instead of X. And then you announce that you're going to do Y, you typically say, this has, you know, we're going to do Y because we're a good company. We're a good organization. We made our own autonomous decision to do Y. It has nothing to do with pressure from those idiotic stakeholders. So you're giving into pressure and pretending you're not. I am not an expert on when you should give into pressure and when you shouldn't, but I am definitely an expert on if you're going to give into pressure, for heaven's sake, say so. And get the outrage reduction value out of having given in. So I tell all my clients, make a list of everything you've ever done because they wanted you to. That's a list of their victories, and that list should be endlessly coming out of your mouth and featured on your website.
Yeah, and this isn't going to happen, but for instance, in Iran and the complaints about the morality police, at least initial reports seem that they're going to disband them, let's say that. But, you know, that's an example. In China, this revolt against all the COVID lockdown restrictions, it seems they're easing those. That'd be another example of what you just talked about. We've caved to all this pressure.
Yeah, if you're going to cave to pressure, that you have nothing to lose and everything to gain by saying you caved to pressure. And, you know, you're just pissing away the value of caving if you pretend you didn't cave.
Yeah, but strongman governments probably resist that idea.
Yeah, well, I haven't done a lot of consulting in communist China.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go on to COVID here. I mean, it was a perfect example of something. Most of the time, what not to do, I think. I don't know. So it was all about risk and crisis communications to me. So what went well, if anything? And then what were the mistakes made and how can we avoid those in the future?
Well, I mean, probably the most important thing to say about COVID communication is even though it was awful, if it had been superb, we'd still be in bad shape. I mean, you know, you don't get to have a pandemic with a pathogen like SARS-CoV-2 and come out smelling like a rose. There were going to be a lot of deaths no matter what. There was going to be unhappiness with the way that the pandemic was managed no matter what. That said, and I think that's important to say, I think the people in charge, both in the Trump administration and in the Biden administration, did a lot of things wrong in the way of communication. If I had to identify one wrong thing, it would have been to pretend you know what you're doing when you don't. It's a lot easier to change policy if you didn't make the first policy sound like a well-informed final decision, you know, science-based perfect answer that nobody could possibly disagree with. It's totally forgivable that they made a lot of bad judgments in the early months of COVID. They were wrong about how it spreads. You know, they thought asymptomatic people couldn't spread it. They were wrong. They thought it was spread mostly by surfaces, and then they thought it spread mostly by droplets. They were wrong both times. It spreads mostly by aerosols. They were wrong about the vaccine. They thought it would take a long time to come up with a vaccine. They were wrong. They had one in less than a year. They thought the vaccine would stop transmission. They were wrong. It doesn't stop transmission. They were wrong about a lot of things. I don't blame them for any of those mistakes. I blame them for every mistake they made overconfidently without saying, this could easily be wrong. We're sailing our boat and building it at the same time. We're coming up with the best advice we can come up with. We're watching, and we may very well change our minds. And it's going to look like we're wishy-washy. It's going to look like we're flip-flopping. It's going to look like we don't know what we're doing because we don't know what we're doing. We're figuring it out as we go along. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of experience in a crisis. If you tell people you're figuring it out as you go along, they go along with you. If you tell people you know what you're doing and this is your final answer and it's sound science and only idiots would think you're wrong, and then you have to change policies, you lose them. And they lost most of the public, you know, at least a good half of the public, by being overconfident about early mistakes.
Okay. So, you know, before we started recording, I mentioned Dr. Fauci, and I was thinking, I thought he did a pretty good job. And I'll let you give your rendition of what you told me and give an example of how you think maybe he wasn't the best communicator.
I mean, I think Fauci is a national hero for what he did with HIV. I think he's been an extraordinary public servant for decades. And speaking as somebody who's 77, I'm perfectly willing to forgive elderly people who start screwing up. So I don't want to make him into an evil person. He's a wonderful person. But I think he did much more harm than good, vis-a-vis COVID. And, you know, one reason is the kind of overconfidence that I talked about earlier. I mean, he was endlessly, sounding like, he was sure. And then changing his mind. And he did that on any number of issues. But also, and this speaks to a different problem that's also common, Fauci is typical of public health or of public health professionals in believing that health is more important than truth. So routinely, Fauci did not, in my judgment, tell us what he believed. He told us what he thought it would be good for us to believe. You can see that perhaps most clearly with regard to masks. When there was a mask shortage early in the pandemic and he wanted to save masks for public health professionals, he didn't say, there's a shortage, I want to save them for public health professionals. He said, they're not going to do you any good. There's no need, there's no reason to wear masks. He had reason to believe in real time when he said that it was not true. And he has admitted in interviews that he didn't say it because he thought it was true. He said it because he didn't want to run on masks. He didn't want people to use masks that he wanted to be saved for public, for hospital people. That's typical of a lot of things public health people do. And, they're much more interested in saving lives than in telling the truth. So they figure out what they want to tell us in order to get us to do what they want us to do. If they want us to get vaccinated, they overstate the value of vaccines because that's how they think they can get us to get vaccinated. And they are willing to mislead us in order to protect us. And that works until it doesn't. Yeah. And every time they do it, they're accumulating a debt in terms of credibility, and eventually, the tipping point is exceeded and they're no longer trusted about anything. I spent decades, Eric, telling health people, you got to stop lying, because eventually people are going to catch on and they won't believe you even when you're telling the truth. And, public health people kept saying back to me, well, it's working so far. We're saving all these lives. And if we started telling the truth, we would save fewer lives. You're wrong. And I was wrong right up until COVID. Hundreds of thousands of people who would be alive today if they'd been vaccinated weren't vaccinated because they mistrusted public health. And they mistrusted public health because it earned their mistrust. And Fauci was in the forefront of earning mistrust.
So the current vaccination rate for the booster is about 15%. Do you think just what you talked about is reflected in that level of vaccination?
Well, it's two things. For healthy young people, it's in my judgment, it's still a good deal to get vaccinated, but it's not a terribly important good deal. Healthy young people are pretty unlikely to, if they have their primary series, if they have their first shots, whether or not they get boosted is relatively unimportant in their health. It's still, they're still healthier, especially vis-a-vis long COVID. I advise my children and my grandchildren to keep getting boosted. But it's not terribly important, not as important for them as it is for you and me. cars wear older. So part of what's going on is people aren't getting boosted because they have higher priorities than getting boosted. But a big piece of what's going on is earned mistrust. And, you know, the fact that you know, the biggest predictor of whether you get boosted is your politics.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
That's horrible. And I blame public health for that much more than I blame Trump.
Okay. Well, I, on this piece, I mean, let's switch. We've been talking COVID. It applies there. But it appears to me that we're not harnessing basic science and communicating better when science, be it a pandemic or climate change, is the topic. So one, talk this in perspective of climate change, and maybe that's the political element of it. What, you know, science doesn't hold sway like it once did.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very complicated stuff. I mean, science, how do I put it? When people tell us to trust science, what they're really telling us to do is trust scientists. And the problem is that becomes harder and harder to do when scientists go beyond science. Here's what happens. Scientists go from data on climate change that's happened to modeling about climate change that might happen, to advice on what they think the world should do in order to reduce the risk of climate change. Okay. Now, if I trust them on the data, but I think the models, maybe yes, maybe no, it's hard to tell, but you know, I don't want to dismiss the models out of hand, but models aren't science. Models are educated guesswork. And I think their advice is flat out political. And it can't be a coincidence that the things they advise are awfully similar to the things they used to advise before they knew about climate. So that, you know, the environmental groups that are against the internal combustion engine were against the internal combustion engine 30 years ago too. What happens is, you know, I think they have sold us on the climate data. They haven't sold us on the climate models, and they haven't sold us on the climate politics. To me, it's stunning, for example, that nobody is working very hard on a politically conservative set of climate change mitigation strategies. I mean, what would you do if you were terribly worried about climate change and you're a political conservative?
Nobody,
there's very little attention given to conservative climate change strategies. The climate change strategies are very lefty, and the climate change people like lefty strategies, and that leaves the people who aren't lefty feeling like they better be anti-climate change, because there isn't any right-wing climate change movement. There could be, there just isn't.
Yeah. One of the things, I'll use the example, and I blogged on this, that, you know, the number that's out there is, you know, 2050 is the magic date. If we haven't kept the, you know, going above 2 degrees Celsius, then we've lost the game and we can never recover and blah, 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 blah. And I agree with that. What I've said is, hey, that's a model. It's possible when we, 100 years from now, we look back at when the tipping point was, it's not in 2050, it was in 2010, you know, type of deal.
Yep.
And so those projections are just that, projections. So I have to agree with you on this. Okay, I've got one last question before we turn it over to any of your last thoughts, but we're living in this fact-less society. Like, when people are presented with facts, they look at it through their own lens and accept or they'll deny facts, that red is not red, red is blue. It just seems like, even with a true fact, not a projection, not a model, it's a fact, people are rejecting facts. And that's that term alternative facts popped up. It's pretty hard, I think, to do risk and crisis and what's your third one there? Communications.
not outrage. You got your
third. Outrage management, precaution advocacy.
Yeah, and precaution
communication.
Advocacy. That's right.
Okay.
So how do you do all that when facts don't matter anymore?
I just don't think that's new. You know, I think people have always been more deeply committed to their values than to any piece of data. You know, we all look at the available information and sieve it through our values and hold dear the information that tells us we're right in our values and ignore or debate or reject the information that tells us we're wrong in our values. I don't think people are any more or less accepting of facts than they used to be. What has changed is that the values debates are different than they used to be, and they're more polarized. They're not more polarized than ever before, but they're more polarized than in the recent past. So, you know, the reason there's more rejection of facts, you know, and it's on both sides. I mean, right-wing people reject the facts of left-wing people. Left-wing people reject the facts of right-wing people. And you know, if you had another hour, I could give you, you know, 50 examples of facts that progressives don't want to know. And they're busy selling, rightly, the facts that conservatives don't want to know. This isn't about being less trusting of facts than we used to be. This is about the fight between progressives and conservatives being harsher than it used to be. And if we want people to pay more attention to facts, you know, the main issue is to get those values battles to be more courteous and more respectful. And that will change how we feel about the other side's facts. We're rejecting the other side's facts because we think the other side is important to reject in every way.
Yeah. Let me insert the word trust in there. It just seems like trust in all institutions. I don't know. Is there an institution left that has the trust that's not the Catholic Church, it's not government? I don't know.
Certainly not media. And it's not scientists.
Yeah. So the lack of trust is also driving a lot of this, isn't it?
I don't think that's a problem. I think it's an achievement. You can't simultaneously ask people to reach thoughtful judgments and to trust experts. If you want us to reach judgments, you're asking us to have a certain level of skepticism about what officials are telling us. So I think learning that the Pentagon might not be telling us the truth, and learning that CDC might not be telling us the truth, and learning that the New York Times might not be telling us the truth, I don't think that's a problem. I think that's a good place to start.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll give you the floor one last time. Any last thoughts to share with the audience about what we discussed here today, or something we didn't say? You know, maybe.
And we've been all over the map. This has been interesting and fun, but I don't know if it's coherent. But
that's a reflection of our two personalities and my question.
But let me go back to something you said right before the break. Where you said in exercises, you know, people invariably say we need to get better at communication, but what they really mean is logistics. And I just want to underline that. I think, you know, yeah, communication logistics are important, but messaging is more important. And even more important than messaging is what I sometimes call meta messaging. How respectful are you of your audience? That's not a message. It's a meta message. You know, how willing are you to acknowledge uncertainty? Your message is not going to be uncertainty. Acknowledging uncertainty about your message is a meta messaging kind of issue. And when I used to do trainings, and I don't do them much anymore, but, you know, I would say, yeah, logistics are important, but I'm not going there. I'm going to focus a little bit on messaging and mostly on meta messaging, because that's where I think the low-hanging fruit is. If people are interested in any of what we talked about, I would be delighted to have them go to my website. You know, my goal in life is to, you know, over the last 20 years was to produce a website that would enable me to retire. And you know, it's not a way of getting more business. It's a way of getting less business. So I urge people to make some use of my website if they found this kind of conversation interesting.
And I'll put a link to it in the description of the podcast there.
Super.
So I'll share one last thing. I believe that you can achieve immortality. And I've written about this recently, and I talk about it, is you do that by sharing everything you know. Don't hold it. Don't be, you know, information is power. I'm sure you agree with that. Share everything you know. Someone will pick it up, like I did, on how to handle a situation where you got an angry mob in a gymnasium. And then share it with everybody else and let that someone else learn from it. Hopefully they'll share it with somebody else. And when you're eventually then gone at 110 there, Peter, get somebody to take over your website so that it keeps going. And it's a source for knowledge and for future generations.
Amen. I worry about that a lot. Well, you know, how do I keep it going after I'm gone? But it's going so far.
All right. Well, I just want to say thank you to Peter Sandman for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast and sharing his wealth of information.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And hopefully you came away from this podcast with a better understanding of risk, crisis communications, and how you can harness that knowledge to improve your ability to communicate, to both warn and inform, be it as a government or as a company. And now a reminder to everyone to be proactive. Think about what you can do today to become better prepared for the next disaster. It's going to the Peter Sandman website for sure. And if you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share it with your email and social media contacts. Thanks for listening and be safe. Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.